Time is running out, the lights fading fast. I spy the judges move about in the past. Drastic measures stem from a vengeful youth. Plastic pleasures amount to the simple truth. Call out tonight and you will be breathless beside the lonely where restless, reckless vampires play.
The radio tower was visible from the highway as Ryan Daly, following the instruction of the GPS, pulled off onto Exit 2 Mill Road and headed into town. From there, he could see most of the town proper, nestled in the valley, lit up like a shiny copper penny as the sun set beneath the mountain to the northwest. For as far as the eye could see, the trees blazed in fiery reds and golds. Foliage in New England's Northeast Kingdom spread every bit as spectacularly as a wildfire, without any of the negative connotations, the incalculable loss of life and property, the ruinous effects on the infrastructure. Quite the opposite. New England foliage was a tourist event and a financial boon to the local economy, frequently the last such occurrence before ski season kicked off. Ryan didn't care about any of that, of course. He wasn't interested in the picturesque view of the town he approached. His eyes, when he could pull them away from the road before him, gravitated back to the radio tower. It wasn't white or red and white the way so many towers were. The wrought iron bars crossing each other, reaching out over the trees to touch the sky, were black. The half a dozen dishes and antenna attached gave the illusion of a charred skeleton's hand reaching out, as if announcing that some terrible evil buried in the earth below was still alive. Ryan hoped so. He was counting on it. A few seconds later, a bend in the road thrust the tower out of sight. The GPS directions took him on a parallel path along the outskirts of town. The vibrancy of the wooded region around him shifted into cool purples as the sun set. After driving another quarter of a mile, the GPS instructed Ryan to turn left onto Old Shelby Road. It wound up a hill to the north side of town, and almost immediately Ryan saw the black fence of the old cemetery. Despite being all alone on the road, he tried to appear nonchalant as he slowed down, casually flicking on his high beams to confirm that the cemetery gate was locked with a heavy rusted chain and padlock. Ryan drove on, having needed only a moment's glance to validate his other suspicion. The cemetery was not regularly maintained. The grass had not been mowed. There were weeds growing over the fence posts. The town would certainly employ a groundskeeper or caretaker to manage the place, but for the grass to be in such a state as it was, whoever was responsible evidently wasn't in a rush. Not truly abandoned was the cemetery, but disused. That was good to know. He drove past the cemetery. There was an unpaved side road that led to a small lake. Ryan had heard that some teenagers died there once, but who knows if that was true. Small towns like this were full of stories like that, local tragedies. This town had one particular story that loomed larger than any other in local legend. It's the reason Ryan was there. Finally, as the last embers of daylight flickered out and night washed over the land, Ryan arrived at his destination. That's how the GPS announced it, anyway. He pulled into a parking lot and did a loop so that his headlights lit up the front of the old abandoned radio station. In January 2004, the Green Mountain Agro and Lumber Company announced it would not renew its broadcasting license and permanently stopped production of all WMPN radio content. This was in reaction to the tragedy that occurred at the radio station 4 months earlier. In September 2003, 13 years before Ryan's fateful journey, listeners tuning in to WMPN's Drive Time radio show, hosted by PJ First, that's First as F-U-R-S-T, heard the popular host T. tease the sports report coming up and then kick out to a commercial break. After 3 30-second paid advertisements ran, a then-popular track by the rock band Blink-182 picked up the silence. Discerning listeners swear they heard the radio host's voice at several times talking over the song, as if his mic was picking up half of a conversation in the studio that it should not have. But no one who claimed to have heard his voice could agree on what he was saying. Some said his voice was too muffled or too quiet, some that he wasn't speaking English, but some other tongue. And then, when the song was over, nothing. Dead air. 20 minutes later, the sheriff and one of his deputies drove up to the radio station. Before the sheriff had even counted all of the bodies, the deputy ran back outside, wiping away tears, to call his pregnant girlfriend just to hear her voice. The sheriff got on the horn with the state police to beg for extra hands, medical examiners, crime scene analysts. The 6 bodies would have to be split up, sent to 2 different morgues in nearby towns with better facilities. Eventually, the FBI would be called in when 2 of the victims could not be identified. Much of the events that took place that day were pieced together and eventually made public, but some remain a mystery to this day. At the center of the carnage, the principal target and perpetrator of the violence was James First, the host of WMPN's morning radio show. He had been the voice of WMPN, of the whole town, for 15 years. They used to put his name on print ads and banners. WMPN, the first in radio. And later, you heard First, playing with his name's homonym. His voice, not so much a deep baritone, but fortified, conveyed strength and sincerity, which made listeners want to trust him instantly. He was also affable, sardonic, and had a sharp Ivy League wit about him. He told stories with a mature frankness that resonated with older audiences, but he could also inject cutting-edge pop culture references and lingo in such a way that didn't sound forced and made younger listeners concede that Jim First was cool. He had also secured his seat of prominence in the town by marrying into the wealthiest family thereabouts. Julia Rankin was practically an heiress and factually a beauty queen. Their courtship was brief, and Jim married her within a year of their first date. But they never had any children. If you believe the small-town gossip, Julia was unable to have children due to a botched abortion procedure when she was in high school. And the thing about small-town gossip is that it's always 100% true. 3 years before his death, Jim First, born James Frederick First, held a months-long fundraiser on his radio show. All the proceeds of a raffle drawing sponsored a group of student athletes, sending them to participate in the Winter Olympics opening ceremony. According to the rules set out at the beginning of the fundraiser, at the end of the drive, Jim First would change his name for 1 year. One lucky raffle ticket holder would decide what name would appear on all of the host's official documents. The winner, it turned out, was a 19-year-old malcontent studying at University of Southern Maine who didn't even remember buying the raffle ticket, having been quite stoned at the time. He was stoned again the day Jim First producer called him to try and get him on the air. For whatever reason, the college kid had kept the raffle ticket and decided on the spot that James First should legally change his name to Pope James First, again playing into the phonetics of the surname. Although Jim First hated it, he would abide by the terms of the contest and the contract that he had signed at the beginning of the summer. He would be Pope James First for 1 year, according to all of his legal documents. His wife was not happy. Although she held most Catholics in a certain contempt, she still found the name offensive and obnoxious and embarrassing to her personally. WMPN's owner, Green Mountain Agro and Lumber, didn't like it either and looked for ways to void that part of the agreement at the risk of upsetting listeners. It was Jim's producer, Rich Stafford, during a conference call with Green Mountain's legal team who asked, "What if we just call him PJ?" It was that simple. On all official documents and forms, Jim was Pope James First. But on WMPN, the first voice in news you can trust, he would be PJ First. And it stuck. If anything, he became more popular. No one who heard the story about the fundraiser was offended that his name was now legally Pope. They thought it was kind of hilarious, and a testament to his character that he would honor his agreement, even with a teenage pothead. So, in 2001, when he changed his name back to James Frederick First, the only one truly happy about it was his wife. On the radio, he kept being PJ. PJ First, the first voice you hear. Several private but long-suspected aspects of PJ's life were brought to the public's attention in the aftermath of his death, along with one curiosity that took everyone, even his closest friends, by surprise. The first worst-kept secret in the kingdom was that PJ had had many affairs during the course of his marriage. Although the couple never talked openly about divorce, both PJ and Julia's family knew that the love had gone out of their relationship almost as quickly as their whirlwind courtship. During their investigation, the police identified 5 different women who admitted to, at different times, conducting affairs with PJ that lasted a couple of weeks up to almost 2 years. Kara Hansen was a 20-year-old staff member of WMPN. Her official title was research assistant, although her duties included managing and providing content for the station's website and getting PJ coffee and water during his show. The police spoke to Kara's roommate after she, too, was identified among the dead at the station. The roommate said Kara told her that she felt like PJ was grooming her, like he was building up to the point where he would initiate a physical relationship. If it hadn't happened yet, it was bound to eventually. Kara had also told her roommate, just the night before she died, that PJ had been sleeping in the station several times that week. PJ First had enjoyed living an extravagant lifestyle, inasmuch as that was possible in the geographic area, but with so many mistresses, that wasn't cheap. The other secret that was not wholly surprising to his friends and family is that PJ had accumulated some serious debt over the last 10 years. Whatever reason he had for staying in what looked like a loveless marriage, it was not financial. Although Julia was fabulously wealthy, her family kept a clenched fist on their assets. PJ had access to only what Julia would give him, a monthly allowance, more or less, that failed to cover all of his expenses. He had borrowed a lot of money from people known and unknown, but in both cases, shady. Maybe PJ had started sleeping at the radio station because his wife had kicked him out. That was certainly possible. But Kara didn't think so, according to what her roommate told the police. She thought he was hiding there, her roommate said in her statement. She said he kept a gun in the studio. Anyone in the town who thought to scrutinize PJ's reckless lifestyle and behavior could put together that the man was cheating on his wife and spending well above his means. Those matters were not so mysterious. What no one in the town, or PJ's surviving friends and family, could explain, however, was the unusual hobby he had taken up just in the month before he died. PJ had taken an inexplicable interest in the occult. Several books on occult practices and satanic worship were found in his home office, their purchases having been very recent. In fact, a final volume ordered online was delivered the day before his funeral. A search of his browser history found more than 100 visits to websites about Satanism or other occult matters. PJ had 2 notebooks, one in his home office and one at the station, full of handwritten notes about supernatural rites, arcane rituals, ancient gods, and resurrections. Several words, if you could call them that, were written over and over in the notebooks, on every page, in the margins, circled, or with other annotations. The sheriff pored over these words. Golgoroth, Cthagan, Yog-Sogoth, Fthag. But he never repeated them, and he never showed the notebooks to anyone else. A pity. Had he shared this info at any point during the investigation, some of the townsfolk who listened to PJ's show the day he died might have recognized those same words speaking over the radio in the seconds before it went to dead air. Ryan Daly approached the lake from the woods instead of the road. It meant walking through the dark for 1 hour and 20 minutes, but it was crucial he remain under the cover of darkness. The chance that anyone would drive around this area was slim, but why take the chance at all? Through the darkened woods, he walked with a backpack slung over his shoulders. Dangling from the backpack like a vestigial tail attached by a carabiner clip was a half-sized shovel. After 10 minutes, he was far enough from the road, and the heavy blanket of trees made it dark enough that he felt safe turning on the flashlight. The beam zigzagged over the ground before him, lighting the path he walked. He checked a compass frequently to make sure he was following the right path. It took him diagonally through the woods to the lake, so that when he finally emerged from the trees, he was less than 200 feet from the side road that bordered the cemetery. He walked along the bank of the river in the opposite direction until he had arrived at his target, which took less than 10 minutes. A thick oak tree infringed on the bank, casting its many branches over the water. Hanging from the thickest of these branches was a length of rope that had, long ago, held a battered car tire for kids to swing out over the water. The rope had frayed and torn, the tire long gone, but the tree was still there, and that's what Ryan cared about. He walked around the trunk, running his flashlight beam methodically over the base. It took him 3 passes to see what had been recorded clearly in his notes. There was a knob in the tree's bark directly above an exposed root. There were actually several, but this particular knob looked like a face. Tiny warps in the wood gave the impression of eyes, and a long gap formed a wide, grinning mouth. You could have carved the face off the tree and placed it atop a stone gargoyle, and no one would have been the wiser. Using his flashlight, Ryan traced the face's line of sight back to the tree line. He counted 20 paces and then stopped. He looked around. Nothing but trees and the lake at his back. He turned the light down at his feet. The ground looked soft. That would help. He removed the backpack and unclipped the shovel. Buried in the dirt beneath him was the thing he sought. He started to dig, and when he dug, he thought about 13 years earlier. Half an hour before the sheriff and his deputy drove to the WMPN station, responding to calls that something weird had sounded on the radio, and then it went silent, a different car had driven up Old Shelby Road and parked in front of the station. The car was a gray mid-90s model Buick LeSabre with New York State license plates. There was nothing in the glove compartment except the owner's manual and road atlas. There was nothing in the console compartment between the driver and passenger seats but an unopened roll of Lifesavers, a package of Kleenex tissues, and a small change dispenser for paying interstate tolls. The dispenser was empty. The car was otherwise empty. There was no trash, no bags of fast food wrappers, no scraps of paper from straws, no bank receipts, nothing. No registration. The car looked off the lot immaculate, like the interior had been thoroughly shampooed that morning. 2 men had exited the car and walked into the radio station. One of them wore a light gray polyester suit with a black tie. He had soft features, a boyish face, and neatly coiffed hair. The other man wore a leather jacket over a polo and chinos. He had a swarthy complexion, deep-set eyes, and salt-and-pepper hair slicked back. The men were greeted in the foyer by the station's receptionist, Rebecca Callahan, who considered herself a shrewd judge of character. The man in gray, Rebecca thought, looked like he was there to hand out religious pamphlets or buy ad time for whatever Christian organization he represented. The other man looked to Rebecca like the sort of fellow you see in crime movies who sells cigarettes out of the back of a truck. She decided she would be more comfortable talking to the man in gray, so she directed her question to him. "Hello, how may I help you?" The man in gray leaned forward over her desk and smiled. Rebecca recoiled in sudden revulsion. The forensic investigators would not be able to tell the police or Rebecca's family what she had been thinking in the seconds before her death, what made her lean back so startled, the pallor already draining from her cheeks. Through the miracle of omniscient narration, however, you can know that the last thought that went through Rebecca's mind was, "Lord, oh Christ, his teeth! They look like shark's teeth!" At which point a bullet fired from a .357 Magnum that was suddenly in the leather jacket man's hand entered Rebecca's left eye socket and exited the back of her skull, taking a quarter of her brain matter with it. Her head swung back, propelling her chair, which was on rollers, to coast back into the wall behind her desk and bounce forward again. A hiss of escaping air wheezed out of her mouth. It sounded like, "Eef!" and then her body slumped to the floor. The shot that ended Rebecca Callahan went unheard by PJ and Rich Stafford, sequestered as they were in the soundproof studio. Kara Hansen had heard the gunshot and recognized the sound, having grown up around guns, but her mind refused to accept the possibility that a gun had discharged in her workplace, even knowing what she knew about PJ. She got up from her cubicle and walked toward the reception area. She halted when the door opened and 2 men walked into the bullpen. No, not men. How could she have thought these 2 were human beings, just because they wore the clothes of men? Something very loud pressed on Kara's mind. Her vision blurred, but for 1 moment, one fraction of a second that would stretch out until her death moments later, she had seen a nightmarish unreality. She had seen snakes, dozens of them, hundreds, slithering beneath the gray suit and the leather jacket, beneath the flesh of the boyish face and the swarthy skin, snakes writhing over each other, entwining with each other, constricting each other, forming two ghastly bipedal gestalts that stood and walked like men. Kara wanted to scream, but her mouth wouldn't work, her lungs wouldn't take in air, her mind wouldn't tell her to do it. The two men, the two things, did not approach her, but walked directly to the studio. But the one in gray turned to look at her. Kara saw his puffy cheeks ripple as the snakes slithered beneath the surface. His mouth opened, and a forked tongue darted out and disappeared. She should run. She knew she should run, but she couldn't move. She was frozen. After all, some deeply recessed part of her brain thought, that's what happens when you look upon the Gorgon. The dig had gone quickly. Barely a foot underground, Ryan's shovel struck something solid. He cleared the rest of the dirt and shone a light down in the hole where it lit up a small wooden chest. Larger than a jewelry box, it looked more like a child's pirate treasure chest. The dimensions, Ryan estimated, were 18 by 10 inches. Luckily, there was no lock on the chest, just a simple handle. Ryan pulled the chest up and set it on the ground beside him. He squatted down and turned the handle. A breath of rank, wet air escaped from the chest as he lifted the lid. Inside was a waterproof, clear plastic bag. Ryan held the flashlight up to see the contents inside the bag. Once satisfied, he opened up his backpack and stuffed the bag inside with the heavy canvas tarp. He clipped the shovel on his backpack again and started down the bank toward the road. He stopped only once when something flew low over his head. A bat. PJ had gone to a song break and leaned back in his chair to stretch when he heard Rich mumble, "Who are these bozos?" That was all the warning PJ got. The recording studio was divided into two booths, one for the host and one for the engineer/producer. The production booth had a window out into the bullpen, so Rich saw the two men approaching. From his chair in front of the microphone, PJ couldn't see them, but he had been ready for this. Beneath the desk, his foot kicked the 12-inch square safe he'd brought in several nights ago. He reached beneath, and, not knowing who or what Rich had seen through the window, PJ reflexively pressed the 5-digit combination, 13975. The door popped open a couple of millimeters. Instead of reaching in to grab the Glock 19, PJ looked back up at his producer on the other side of the booth, just in time to see his best friend's final moments of life. The door from the bullpen opened, and two men began to file, shoulder to shoulder, through the opening. Rich put his hand up in front of the man who dressed like a Bible salesman and started to tell them they weren't allowed in here during the broadcast. That's when the man in gray, who was no longer a man at all but some kind of wolf, his features weren't soft, they were covered in a thick, oily fur. The wolf thing lunged forward, catching Rich Stafford's entire hand in his mouth and chomped down on it. As blood squirted out, staining the man-wolf's face red and spraying the window to the bullpen and the sound mixing board, Rich stumbled backwards, squealing in pain and disbelief. PJ ducked down and drew the gun from his safe. With his head below the desk, he could no longer see Rich, but the man's squealing was abruptly replaced by the sound of two thunderous gunshots. The producer fell back onto the board, spilling a coffee mug and a stack of loose papers, and accidentally boosting the gain on the microphone. Beneath the desk, PJ prayed, not to any respectable god, but to others. Then he rose from behind the desk, knocking the microphone aside and aimed the Glock at the two intruders. PJ first had practiced firing the weapon at a shooting range exactly one time, and his accuracy was what professional marksmen would call god-awful. So perhaps there was some other force at work directing his line of fire that day, because the first bullet ripped through the cheek of the one wearing a leather jacket. The rest of the volley of shots zeroed on the one in gray. He danced backwards, spinning out into the bullpen as 8 bullets tore into his midsection. The other wayward round zipped over the man's shoulder and sailed down the length of the bullpen until it struck Kara in the neck. She dropped right there on the floor where she had been paralyzed by fear and was dead within seconds. Her last thought was of a giant snake coiling around her eyes, blotting out the light. In the studio, the man in leather stood up, The right side of his face was cratered, the skin around the wound was sliding off like burnt cheese, and the eye dangled from an orbital socket that no longer existed. He threw himself at PJ, who snapped off 3 more shots into the man's stomach before they collided and fell to the floor together. The gun bounced out of PJ's grip and slid under the desk. PJ scrambled to his knees, but his attacker was too fast and too strong. The man, or monster, climbed onto PJ and sat on his back, forcing all of the air out of his lungs. The man who had been the voice of the town, the first voice in radio, could not speak, could not call for help, could not plea for mercy, could not even utter a sound. The gun, the only thing that might save him, was 2 feet out of reach where it had fallen. It might as well have been a mile. A pair of wet, putrid, furry hands grabbed PJ around the head and lifted it back off the floor. Pain arced all down his back, beneath his shoulders, and the base of his skull. He closed his eyes. The killer didn't make him suffer for long. Something cold and metal streaked across his throat. Then, blessedly, the pain in his back stopped as the hand let go of his head so it could splash down in the gathering pool of his own blood. The man in leather pulled himself up off the dead radio host and gave the body a kick for good measure. He took 2 steps back and leaned against the wall to catch his breath. Then, as if it had just occurred to him that he had been shot 4 times, his legs buckled and he dropped dead beside PJ's body. By the time all the corpses were being taken out, there wasn't a dry inch of carpet in the studio booths. James Frederick First, Richard Matthew Stafford, Rebecca Lynn Callahan, and Kara Jean Hansen were easily identified. They were each buried or cremated as to his or her wishes within a week of the massacre. The 2 men who came to kill PJ First were never identified. They had no identification on them, and all other attempts to find out who they were failed. They had no fingerprints in the national database, no dental records, no social security. Even though the man in the leather jacket had a United States Marine Corps tattoo and the man in gray bore an appendectomy scar, they had no records of any kind. The car they arrived in was not registered to anyone. It wasn't reported stolen or missing from any rental agency. The FBI tried to find out who they were and came up empty. They even reached out to Interpol. They blamed their failure on shoddy forensic work by the local Bumpkin Police Department. Every blood, hair, and DNA sample from the 2 killers was corrupted, tainted at the crime scene, they assumed, by some kind of wild dog. How else could they have had traces of lupine DNA in the samples? 13 years after the WMPN massacre, Ryan Daly broke into the cemetery down the road from the radio station. To the north, where the property bordered a thick wooded area adjacent to the lake, the black iron bars gave way to a cheaper, more conventional, 6-foot-tall chain-link fence. At the top of the fence were twisted barbs. Ryan stopped at the fence and took his backpack off again. He pulled the waterproof bag out and set it down, almost gently, then removed the heavy canvas tarp. He left the candles and the other items inside. Without laying it over the ground, he folded the tarp so that it was 2 feet and then folded it again and again on top until it made a thick cushion. He dropped it on top of the fence. He pulled out 2 strips of twine, weaving them through the fence and over the tarp, tying it down so that a full 6 inches of canvas rested atop the barbs. He unclipped the shovel from the backpack and heaved it over the fence. Then he put the waterproof bag back inside the pack and dropped it over the side of the fence too. He tossed the flashlight so that it would land on the backpack and soften the fall, just in case it was liable to break. Then Ryan climbed up the fence. He put his hands on the canvas and pulled himself up and over. The tarp did the trick. He couldn't even feel the barbs beneath when he slid over the edge. Only one of his knees scraped a barb. It didn't rip through his pants, but he felt a trickle of blood run down his shin. Then he dropped down into the cemetery. Picking up the backpack, the shovel, and the flashlight, he set out to find the grave of James Frederick First. It was 11:50 when he found it. There wasn't much time, so he went right to work. He set the flashlight down, pointing the light at PJ's headstone. Opening the backpack, Ryan took out the waterproof bag, 5 candles, a tin thermos, a 10-ounce bottle of water, and a 40-ounce bottle of Jim Beam. The water was for him. He guzzled down a third of the bottle right away. He opened the bottle of bourbon and poured it out on the grass, forming a large circle 3 feet in diameter around the grave. Next, he took the thermos and knelt down at the foot of the stone. He unscrewed the top and winced as the metallic smell of blood seeped out. With much more care and precision than he'd done with the Jim Beam, Ryan poured the thermos of blood onto the soft ground at the front of PJ First's grave. He did not pour it in the shape of a circle, however, but that of a five-pointed star, a pentagram. There was a little bit of blood left in the thermos after he finished, and he dribbled it over the top of the headstone. Droplets leaked down the front over First's name. In the dim glow from the flashlight, the blood looked more black than red. Next, Ryan got the five candles and placed them at the five points of the star. He lit each one with a single match struck on the first try. Then came the final stage of preparation. He took another swig from his water bottle and then got the waterproof bag. Off in the distance somewhere, an owl hooted. Tearing open the bag, Ryan removed the contents that he had unearthed from a buried treasure chest. His thumb ran over the smooth mylar plastic. He flipped through, counting each item. 13. 13 bagged and boarded comic books. Tracing the circle he had poured with the bourbon, Ryan removed each of the comics from their mylar protection and placed the copy on the ground in the circle around the grave. As he did, he spoke the series title aloud. House of Mystery. Ghosts. House of Secrets. Night Force. Tales of the Unexpected. Dead Man. Doorway to Nightmare. Swamp Thing. Secrets of Haunted House. Weird War Tales. The Spectre. The Phantom Stranger. And last, Midnight. The Witching Hour. Thus the circle of comics and whiskey was complete. The blood pentagram with the candles at the five points. The preparation was complete. A wind kicked up through the cemetery. The candlelight flickered, but did not blow out. He checked the time. The witching hour was indeed upon them. In the dark night of the graveyard, standing up on the plot of a dead radio host, Ryan Daly read the scripted words of the resurrection ritual. As the wind howled and animals screeched in the woods, Ryan invoked the names of his dark gods. Wrightson, Ween, Orlando, he summoned. Dorfman, Colon, Dezeniga, Wolfman, Aragones, Aparo. Thunder rumbled overhead, and a bolt of lightning out of the cloudless sky arced down and struck the lake. The soft ground billowed and split like cloth as a gnarled and withered hand stabbed out of the earth. The five candles blew out. Ryan took two steps backward and tripped over the shovel. He fell on his back, kicking out and knocking the flashlight over. Suddenly plunged into pitch darkness, Ryan rolled onto his stomach and crawled over to the flashlight. He tapped it on the ground and light came back on. He pointed it at the grave. The hand was still there, clawing at the ground, feeling around. Ryan sat up on his knees and watched as the decaying hand, with cracks and tears in the flesh but no blood, scuttled like a crustacean over the grass until one of the fingers brushed against the cover of a house of mystery. Touching the cover again, feeling its size and dimensions, the ragged fingertips gingerly played over the cover art. And then, with the speed of a poisonous snake, the hand grabbed the comic and pulled it back down into the ground. Ryan crawled over the hole at the grave. He shone the flashlight down there, but all it revealed was a never-ending blackness. What came out of the hole had no body, no shape or form. It was merely a voice, once the voice of a radio host, whose throat had been cut so deeply that the blade scraped the bone. Now just a voice, giving its first impression of a horror comic. "Nice," PJ said. The Secret Origin of PJ Frightful is written by Ryan Daly. Happy Halloween, listeners, and welcome to the 31st episode of Midnight, the podcasting hour. I'm Ryan Daly, and as you've no doubt realized by now, this is going to be a pretty different episode than usual. I wanted to do something different for the big number 31, as it's also the Halloween episode for this year. People have been asking for a couple of months, where's PJ Frightful? And I will tell you more about what is going on currently with PJ later in this episode, but to prime you for that in the future of this podcast, I wanted to at last reveal the heretofore unknown secret origin of PJ Frightful. So that is what you've just heard. I hope you liked the story. That's one that I've been sitting on for about 4 years. But this is still ostensibly a DC Comics podcast, so we've got a book to cover. And even though we're already 35 minutes into the show, I went big again. I am going to cover the complete Dead Man, Dark Mansion of Forbidden Love miniseries. And I will not be doing it alone. I have brought along, sorta, I'll be talking anyway, to three returning guests about this book. Doug Zavisha, Nathaniel Wayne, and Martin Gray. Martin was actually generous enough to send me the trade paperback collecting the series. That's one of the things that motivated me to cover this. So give big hug and thanks to Martin. Well, give socially distanced hugs and thanks to Martin. But, as I alluded to before, I'm going to approach this one a little bit differently than usual. I didn't record with all three guys together, and I didn't even review the issues with them separately. I basically interviewed them each about one particular aspect of the story, whether it was the characters, the setting, or some other element that seemed relevant. So, I am going to give you the beats of all six chapters of Dead Man, Dark Mansion of Forbidden Love, and then you will hear me talking to Doug, Martin, and Nathaniel after that. Yes, I realize in hindsight that might not have been the best method for reviewing these stories when I already spoke by myself for half an hour to start this episode, but that's what we're going to do. So, Dead Man, Dark Mansion of Forbidden Love is a three-issue miniseries, but each issue is double-sized and divided into two chapters, so it's six chapters in all, and reading it, you can pretty clearly see that this was supposed to be a six-issue miniseries. For whatever reason, DC must have thought that sales would be better if they condensed it into three issues released bi-monthly instead of six over the same period, but with a higher price point for the added pages per issue. I don't know if that worked or not. I have no idea what the sales were on this book. But anyway, since we're talking six comics, essentially, I'm going to try and cruise through my synopsis of this book at a slightly quicker pace. I'm still going to give you all of the salient points, though, the skeleton of the story, as it were. And after that, you will hear from my guests. Dead Man, Dark Mansion of Forbidden Love is written by Sarah Vaughn, with art by Lan Medina. It's lettered by Janice Chang, colored by Jose Villarubia, and edited by Alex Antone. Stephanie Hans provided the cover art for all three issues, each of which cost $5.99 in the U.S. Issue 1 was released on October 5th, 2016, Issue 2 on December 7th, and Issue 3 on February 8th, 2017. And as I mentioned, all three issues are collected in trade paperback, which was released in May of 2017. Issue 1, Chapter 1, A House Awakens. A ghost runs through a mansion, screaming. Elsewhere, Bernice rides with her non-binary friend Sam, talking about the antiques show they were at. They drive up to Glencourt Manor, a huge Gothic mansion with a lot of history. Bernice is apprehensive because she sees Dead Man has followed them to the mansion, and she watches him fly inside. Yes, Bernice can see Dead Man. She is able to see ghosts, but she notices that Dead Man is different from the normal ghosts. He's more lively, in a sense. Bernice and Sam go into the house. She sees Dead Man fly directly at Sam as if he will fly into them, but instead, Dead Man seems to bounce off, quite surprised. Without tipping Sam off to the fact that she sees ghosts, Bernice tries to get them outside when Dead Man flies into her. We relive Bernice's oldest memory from when she was a baby. Her parents tried to calm her down after a nightmare, but when they left the room, she still saw the ghost. Bernice wakes up in the drawing room 5 minutes later with a very confused Sam. Dead Man has left her body and is staring at the portrait of a beautiful woman on the wall. Bernice's boyfriend Nathan comes to comfort her. Nathan is a writer, and his uncle died recently and left him the mansion. When he gets a headache, Bernice tries to comfort him, but sees a ghostly black shadow fill the room and surround Nathan. A presence from the doorway tells her she should leave, or the house will destroy her. Dead Man chases the shadow out into the hall. Bernice walks Nathan back to his study. He's trying to finish writing a book, but his headaches have been getting worse since they moved into the house a few months ago. She leaves him to write and heads back to Sam when the shadows come back and chase her. She sees Dead Man at the front door punching at it, but having no effect. She runs into one of the rooms and finds Sam admiring all of the antiques. They show her that a Korean antique she bought from the show was broken somehow. At this, the shadows come into the room, threatening to destroy Bernice again, but this time Dead Man comes back and punches the shadow. Chapter 2, Bernice and the Dead Man. Dead Man punches the shadow, which resists, and then the shadow flees the room, closing the door behind it. Dead Man tries to follow, but can't get through the door, and you can imagine he's pretty pissed that the usual rules of what he can and can't do as a ghost don't seem to work here. He flies back into Bernice, reliving another one of her memories. This time, she had told her lover, Tala, a message that Tala's mother wanted passed from beyond the grave. Tala did not take the message or its source very well and broke up with Bernice. It seems that seeing and speaking to the dead has led to a lonely life. Using Bernice's body, Dead Man runs from the room down the hall, slides down the banister of the grand staircase, and tries to leave the mansion, but is stopped by magical energy. Sam follows Bernice, shocked by her behavior. When they take her hand, Dead Man is thrown from Bernice's body. Sam sees that Bernice is upset and comforts her. In fact, they almost kiss, but Bernice tells Sam they should probably leave. Sam takes the broken Korean antique and tells Bernice they will be there if she needs them, and then drives off. Alone together at last, Bernice calls out Dead Man and demands to know what the hell is going on. He explains that he heard or felt someone in danger from this mansion, so he came here to help. Now he feels like he walked into a trap, though, because he can't leave and there's powerful magic at work in the house. Bernice makes him promise that he will never take possession of her body again without permission, even if her life is in danger. Then she agrees to help Dead Man solve the mystery if it means the house will go back to normal. He says the ghost he saw screaming for help was the same woman in the portrait. Bernice doesn't know much about the house and its history, but there's one place that she hasn't checked, the attic. They go up there and find a chest that seems out of place. Inside the chest is a trove of trinkets and personal belongings, and a picture of the ghost, a woman named Adelia Ruskin, who died over 100 years ago. They use Adelia's belongings to channel her spirit. The lights go out and the ghost appears. Adelia is in turmoil. She tells them the darkness is coming. Dead Man tells Adelia that he will help her and the two join hands. With that, a gust of air blows the papers and relics out of the chest. When it clears, Bernice looks around to find herself alone in the dark. Issue 2, Chapter 3, Dark Spaces and Open Doors. Dead Man and Adelia are in another place. It's all black and we can't see Bernice. Adelia says this is the only other place besides the mansion that she's able to go to. Dead Man convinces her that he is a ghost like her, but he has powers and he wants to help her figure out her situation. She is almost amnesiac. They bond, more or less physically, and he gets flashes of her memories. Her wedding day, the day she moved into Glencourt Manor as it was being built, and the moment she was violently stabbed to death by someone we can't see. The memory, as you might imagine, makes Adelia quite angry. Dead Man calms her down by telling her the story of how he died. When they touch hands, she says she feels more alive and focused, while he thinks he feels more like a ghost. Dead Man wants to get back to Bernice. Together, the ghosts leave the black place and return to the mansion. Bernice is sitting on the floor of the study, sorting through papers and relics from the chest. She's dressed noticeably different than when Deadman last saw her in the attic. Bernice tells Deadman that he and Adelia were gone for days, but in that time, the house has been quiet. No shadow demon sightings or anything like that. Plus, it gave her time to investigate Adelia's belongings. She learned that Adelia married Edward Ruskin, the first owner of Glencourt Manor. She bought a ring in 1875 and planned to send it to her mother, the same ring that Bernice and Deadman found in the attic and Bernice now wears. At that moment, a kind of spiritual psychic shock rips through Adelia and Deadman and forms a golden circle around Glencourt. The two ghosts fall down in spasms of agony. As Bernice is trying to find out what's happening to them, her boyfriend Nathan walks in. He's still oblivious to the ghosts, remember. He's apologetic that he's neglected her so much of the last 4 months since they moved in, but he's almost done writing his book and promises to make it up to her. After Nathan leaves, the others start to recover, which isn't weird or suspicious or anything. Bernice says they need to investigate further. She had been in the house for months without any sign of ghostly activity or ever seeing Adelia. The magic forces in the house were dormant, so what woke them up? She goes to her room to get some things, but Adelia and Deadman are blocked by the magical barrier from following her. Bernice says her room is in a different part of the manor that was built after the original, after Adelia died, and maybe that's why the ghost can't enter. Bernice gets her jacket and things and leaves the ghosts behind, telling them she'll do what she can to help them. Chapter 4. Questions and Answers. Bernice walks through the woods into the nearby town. She goes to the library and looks up Adelia and Glencourt. She finds out Adelia and Edward Ruskin spent their wedding night in the mansion before it was finished being built. Adelia disappeared that night, and her body was never recovered. The police investigated but could find no evidence of foul play, and Edward Ruskin left the mansion a year later. Over the years, the house has passed from one owner to another, always maintaining a skeleton crew staff to maintain the house and grounds. Adelia's spirit has been there the whole time, but there have been no reports of ghostly activity or paranormal sightings in the local papers. Bernice goes to Sam's antique shop. She apologizes for the awkward way things ended when they left the house days ago. Sam tells Bernice how important she is to them, how she has always accepted them. Bernice considers telling Sam the truth about her unique ability, but Sam interrupts by giving her a gift, the Korean bowl that was shattered, now glued back together. Bernice embraces Sam in gratitude. For a moment, she flashes to an image of them kissing passionately, not sure if it's a dream, a premonition, or what. Sam drives Bernice back to Glencourt. They go inside to find Nathan and the ghosts waiting expectantly. Nathan tells Bernice that he finally finished his book and they can move out of the mansion whenever she wants. This catches her off guard, but even more surprising is when Nathan gets down on one knee and proposes to her. Before Bernice can answer, he slips the ring on her finger, right next to Adelia's ring. A surge of poltergeist activity kicks up. Adelia starts screaming in agony as Deadman tries to help her. Nathan falls to the ground in the grip of another headache. Wind gusts blow papers around and shatter vases. The room trembles as Sam wonders what the hell is going on. And at the center, Bernice just stands there, transfixed, witnessing a vision of a black book and hearing the voice of the evil shadows telling her she will die if she marries Nathan, telling her to leave the house. Bernice tells Sam the darkness is getting closer. Deadman tries to comfort Adelia, but the shadow creeps up, overtaking her, changing her body into a shadow monster, and she reaches out to attack Nathan. Issue 3, Chapter 5, The Key to It All. Bernice is overwhelmed by Adelia's fear, which manifests as a shadow monster trying to kill Nathan, saying he doesn't deserve to live as long as he has. Deadman reaches for Adelia and helps her break free of the shadow's influence. Once back in her usual ghost form, Adelia disappears to her other place, and Deadman tries to follow her. Sam and Nathan wonder, quite understandably, what just happened, and Bernice tells them the truth, including the part where she has always been able to see and communicate with ghosts. Sam believes her, but Nathan is skeptical. Then Nathan has another terrible headache and repeats what he told Bernice before, that they can leave the house now that he has finished the book. Bernice helps Nathan settle down to rest, but she refuses to leave Glencore until they've resolved the situation with Adelia and Deadman. She says even though Sam claims to have never experienced anything supernatural, they are nevertheless connected to it. Deadman could not possess them, and their touch knocked Deadman out of Bernice's body when he possessed her. Bernice thinks they're fated to be together. She also suspects that Nathan is somehow tied to this. Adelia freaked out right after Nathan proposed, which Bernice never answered, by the way. Together, Bernice, Sam, and Deadman go to investigate the one part of Glencore that she hasn't checked out, Nathan's study. They call to Adelia, who nervously joins them from the other space. Inside the study, they find huge bookshelves of tomes on the occult and the dark arts written in every language. On the writing desk is an ancient leather-bound spellbook. When Bernice gets close to it, Nathan slams it shut and demands to know why she is in there, why she violated her promise to never invade his private space. Bernice, rightly, is all, "Screw your privacy, what are you doing with a spellbook and a library of dark arts texts?" Adelia starts to freak out again, and Nathan takes out a ceremonial dagger, the same one used to kill her 150 years ago. He doesn't know why the last binding spell didn't work, but it doesn't matter now. He attacks Bernice, but Sam grabs him. The two fight, and Nathan ends up stabbing himself in the chest, which doesn't hurt him at all because of a spell that he cast that as long as the mansion stands, so will he. Tricky bastard. Adelia rages at the memory of being murdered by her husband, causing another gust of energy that shatters glass and knocks books off shelves. Nathan closes in on Bernice and Sam. Deadman promised not to possess Bernice, so instead he flies into Nathan's body, and once there, he is flooded by the memories of more lifetimes than one man should have. Chapter 6. Getting Back the Time He Took. Taking possession of Nathan, Deadman relives his memories, realizing that Nathan is in fact Edward Ruskin. He wanted to live forever, so he murdered his wife Adelia on their wedding night as part of a ritual sacrifice. He called on the dark forces to cover up her death and keep him immortal as long as Glencourt Manor stood. But the fatal act bound Adelia's ghost to the house as well. Edward left and changed his identity. Every 20 years or so, he would have to abandon his current life when people started to realize that he didn't age at all. When this happened, he would return to the mansion and perform the binding spell again, banishing Adelia to the other place of blackness, and then he would establish a new identity. For some reason, it didn't work this most recent time, as Adelia was able to call out for help, possibly because of the presence of Bernice. Deadman relays all of this to Bernice and Sam in Nathan's body as Adelia calls on the shadow energy in her rage and attacks him. She can't see that it's Deadman, only her murderous husband, and she wants revenge. In their struggle, they knock over the writing desk and candlesticks. Remembering the spell that Edward would live as long as the house did, and the fact that the knife to his chest didn't hurt him, Bernice gets the idea to destroy the house. She starts throwing books into the fire set by the candlesticks. She and Sam run out of the study, setting fire to the house and all of the antique furniture that Sam will miss so much. Bernice calls out to Adelia, saying they will need her supernatural power to destroy the house. The fire won't be enough. Adelia is able to sense Deadman inside her husband's body, but she is so full of rage she wants to kill him. Deadman tells her that's okay, she deserves to be angry. He encourages her to feel her grief and her anger and let it all go by destroying Edward slash Nathan and the house. Adelia unleashes all of her supernatural energy in a wave that knocks the walls down. Bernice and Sam escape the mansion just before it collapses, having salvaged only the Korean bowl that Sam repaired. Fire engulfs Edward slash Nathan, who dies as Deadman rejects from his body. As the smoke clears, nothing remains of Glencourt Manor but a smoking pit. Bernice thinks the police will charge them with arson and murder, but Sam suggests the police won't be able to make any sense of the crater where the mansion used to stand, and they'll be fine. Bernice throws the engagement ring into the pit. Deadman and Adelia's ghosts spring out of the ground. Adelia feels happy and warm for the first time, her spirit truly at peace and ready to move on. She bids a sad farewell to Deadman, thanking him for helping her, and then she leaves the world of the living. Deadman thanks Bernice and Sam for helping him too, noting that a couple, one who can commune with ghosts and one impervious to them, is quite remarkable. Then Deadman hears the call of someone else in danger, and he flies off to help. Martin Gray. The story, I mean, it borrows from classical gothic romance stories. It's Bluebeard and Rebecca and all of these old things. As a gothic story, how do you think it works?
Well, I think it pretty much works pretty well, because we have the innocent young woman moving into an old dark house with a past. Mm-hmm. The house is owned by the brooding genius with secrets, like Maxim de Wynne. You've got this study that must never be entered. And Bernice says at one point, the house is just waking up, which recalls things like, you know, the haunting. Mm-hmm. And it all says gothic to me. But also, I like that the book has a very modern spin, in that instead of the usual lily-white protagonists, you have Bernice, who is mixed race and bisexual. Mm-hmm. And then you have Sam, who is a trans character. And Sam is there, the safe harbour, opening new possibilities to Bernice. I think it's pretty darn gothic. I mean, you know, even on the front cover of the first issue, she's doing the whole gothic thing, you know, dressed in the gothic type dress, although it's reflecting Dead Man's colours. I think they're hitting the mark there.
Doug Zavisha, how do you think this works as a Dead Man story?
It's not the strongest application of the character. It's not a Dead Man hero story. But Deadman is DC's, and I think we maybe went down this road before in a conversation. And he's not just DC's. I think he may be comics' overall most versatile character, in that he can go into any type of story and be part of that story. Will he be an active part? Will he be the protagonist? Will he be just kind of a cameo or a fluff character? Well, you know, that depends on the writer, their strengths, and their interest in Deadman. I would say that Vaughn may not have had Deadman at the heart of her story, but yes, it's a Deadman story. But to me, when I was reading this, it struck me as more in line with the Phantom Stranger series, you know, where he'd kind of be there, but not really have much of an impact in the way things went.
I didn't do any research into the origin or the gestation of this series, so I don't have any idea, like, what made DC or the writer decide to sort of merge these two things of taking Deadman and putting him into this type of story, or the fact that, I mean, they're calling it a Dark Mansion of Forbidden Love, which was a title they had, you know, 40 years ago. Yeah, where do you think this came from? Why did they think this would work?
I think Deadman does actually go with the idea of the gothic romance, because he's hopeless love. I mean, the first ever Dead Man story I read was in Brave and Bold. I went back and had a look. It was 104. And back then, he's falling for a woman who turns out to be bad. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he thinks they can be together. And, you know, at the end, she dies. And then, you know, she's not reincarnated as a spirit because she's bad. So, you know, right back then, you keep wailing to the elements of Rama, whatever a spirit guide chap is. And so many Dead Man stories over the years I've read where he does have a hopeless love. It just goes on and on, because I think it seems that ghosts can never find happiness with a living soul outside of things like, you know, the movies Ghost and The Ghost and Mrs. Muir. Mm-hmm. It's like the nigh inevitability of failed love in a gothic romance pretty much suits Dead Man down to the ground, down to 6 feet under, maybe. And Boston Brand, he's dead, yes, but he's a romantic figure. He's still dashing. He's the acrobat. He just never gives up. I mean, he's like a romantic pirate figure, even in his book in the Mansion book. He's trying to get memories from Adelia, the ghost, by planting a kiss on her, which, you know, he shouldn't be doing anyway, because it's not very peak. But he's an old-fashioned guy. He's a romantic figure, and I think he fits very well into a gothic romance.
A romantic pirate figure. I never thought of him that way, but that really works. I like that idea. How do you think Sarah Vaughan wrote the character? Do you think you felt like he was true to form?
No, I really don't. Kind of wobbling on this one. No, I don't think he was true to form in that she, Sarah Vaughan wrote him more as a detective type of guy or a diving in head first true hero, but didn't really seem to put much behind that. He was truly a plot device to get things done. In thinking about this question, if you could have seen the thought balloon by my head when you asked if Dead Man was true to form, my answer immediately would have been no, yes, question mark, no. I'm going to land with no. I'm going to stick with no. Final answer. He wasn't really true to form, but then again, you know, he's a flexible character that certainly has had some range over his time. And this came out in, I think it was 2016. So there was that really kind of weird transition, rebirth, New 52. You know, what's really going on? When did Sarah Vaughan actually start writing this relative to its release?
And yet, for having his name above the fold and for being the premier superhero character in this, what is this, a comic book from a superhero publishing company, he's not really our protagonist. As you mentioned, Bernice is our protagonist. She's our POV character. It all spins around her figuring out, putting things together through this mystery. Do you think that works in the story?
I think it does, because I'm very familiar with Dead Man, and he gets to be, you know, the friendly ghost, whereas Bernice is a new rich character to be introduced to. It's interesting to see Dead Man through her eyes, and it just makes Dead Man unfamiliar, puts new magic into him. And I just liked, you know, to having someone new to explore this dark, dangerous romantic world with, you know. It means, you know, Dead Man gets to be the eerie character of a change rather than in his superhero mode. I mean, he says himself that at one point he says that he prefers, you know, dealing with small-time hoodlums and things, but he's well-suited to the spooky stuff. So, you know, stick him in a haunted house and he expects that he'll be able to handle anything that comes up.
I think it was a little bit jarring. It took me a little bit to get a handle on things with having him not be our POV. I'm familiar with his character. I know what he should be capable of and what he can't. And Bernice, I don't know who she is, but she's able to see him, but she's not freaking out about the fact that she can see this ghost. And we see when he starts bumping up against these obstacles, like he can't go through certain walls, he can't leave this house. It's like, okay, that shouldn't be a problem for him if we know the character. But seeing it through her eyes, I don't know, there were times when I felt like it was, I was on the level, and then I was kind of thinking, I was like, I'm not sure if you don't know the character of Dead Man, this could be a much more confusing introduction to the character, seeing him through her. And I just felt like maybe, like, structurally, I don't know, like, if this was the first time you were ever reading a comic or a graphic novel or something like this, and you didn't necessarily know the rules for this character, I might have wanted a little bit more linear structure and kind of figuring out who Bernice is, what she can do in terms of her connection to the supernatural, and kind of get a, what's her status quo before we see her meeting Dead Man, who is different from every other ghost that she's ever interacted with. And again, it wasn't a problem or a hang-up for me because I know who Dead Man is, but I couldn't help thinking somebody who doesn't know the character very well, would this trip them up?
I don't know. I wish we did have someone who was in that position to ask, because you are right, because, you know, we are intimately familiar with Dead Man, but I think pretty quickly we get to know about what Bernice can do. And when Dead Man starts doing the narration himself in the second chapter, which is in the first part of the first issue of the three, because it seems like it was written as six issues and then it was put into three books. And I think he explains himself pretty quickly, but I wish we did have someone who could tell us how they felt if they were coming to it for the gothic romance and the spookiness, but didn't necessarily know Boston Brand the way we do.
Right. I like Bernice being our POV character. I think that functions for the story. She is the governess coming to this, haunted mansion, like figuring out all the dark secrets that you laid out, the room that she's never allowed to enter, the boyfriend, fiance with his own little, secrets and everything. Like, first of all, I mean, how obvious was it that Nathan was going to be the big bad guy at the end of the story? Like every time he walks in a room, weird stuff starts happening.
Yeah, I mean, even if he didn't have the weird stuff, Ryan, I mean, the second he arrives on panel, he's looking slimy, supercilious.
Yeah.
And he notices that Bernice is sort of holding Sam's hand instinctively, and he gets physically possessive, grabbing her, holding her from behind. Mm-hmm. And then he starts telling her what to think, almost as if he's gaslighting, which he's not. But how did the expectation that Nathan would be the villain, did that hurt the story for you at all?
No, because he was sort of like I don't want to say the least threatening, but even though you knew that something was up with him, there were so many more obvious signs, like this like weird sort of ghost shadow spirit thing that's coming out of nowhere, and whatever is coming out with the other ghost, the woman who's running around screaming her head off. And so there were a lot of distractions and a lot of more colorful supernatural aspects to keep your mind occupied. So it's like, okay, I don't trust this guy, and it's probably going to come out at the end that he's a bad guy, but focusing on other things. So maybe that was intentional.
Absolutely. And I find it quite fun to have someone to be suspicious of and to think, are they going to subvert expectations and have him turn out to be not the villain after all? And as you know, they didn't, but and as you say, there's so much else going on, and it's fun, and it's enjoyable how he does fit into things in the end.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Nathaniel Wayne. We're introduced to Bernice, who is the sort of protagonist of this gothic romance, as being a young woman thrust into a haunted house situation. But she's unusual or atypical for a couple of reasons. One being her connection to the supernatural, in that sixth sense sort of way that she can see and commune with ghosts. She's also queer and bisexual, in this case. How did you feel that read? How was it presented, do you think? Was it presented well? Did it feel relevant or significant?
Well, here's the thing with Bernice's bisexuality. Was it particularly significant? No, I don't think so. Was it presented well? Yes, because there was virtually no attention drawn to it.
Mm-hmm.
And here's the thing. I don't mean to dig at you a little bit, but I actually kind of take issue with the question.
Okay.
Was it relevant? Because is it relevant that she's white? Is it relevant that she is able-bodied? Why are the things assumed to be standard never have to be justified, but anything that is not part of the standard template, it has to somehow contribute, otherwise it shouldn't be there.
That's fair. And you're right to ask that, to ask the question back to me. I think maybe the point that I was coming from was, by the time I got to it, I was like, okay, she's presented, okay, she's bisexual, but for the purposes of this story, she is still in a romance with a man. So,
yes.
Like, I mean, had she been called heterosexual, had that just been her type, or had it never even come up, the purposes of the story for plot's sake wouldn't have changed. So,
no, it wouldn't, but I'm kind of the opinion, like, the purpose of the flashback was to establish that this has disrupted her relationships before, when she's tried to be open with people about her ability to speak with the dead. And honestly, the sex of the person who she had that breakup with doesn't matter. And when it doesn't matter, my answer is there's no reason for it not to be a woman.
Mm-hmm.
Did it need to be a woman? No, but it didn't need to be a man either.
But you also didn't feel like it was just paying lip service to her queerness, but it wasn't like – it wasn't a situation where – I hate to even bring the woman up now, but it wasn't like something like J.K. Rowling after the fact saying, oh yeah, Dumbledore was gay, but there was nothing in the text that would have ever confirmed or refuted that one way or another.
So depending on how you choose to look at the way that Sam, who I know we haven't started talking about yet, but I know we're going to, gets integrated into the story, you could make the argument that part of the purpose for establishing Bernice as bisexual is to eliminate any possible doubts about her having an attraction to Sam. Because if you demonstrate that Bernice has had attractions to men and to women, then it's not a huge leap that she would have an attraction to someone non-binary. And there is – and that may be the reason – now, that doesn't affect the actual story. That's not a narrative reason. That's a meta reason. That's a audience getting them on the same – on the page as the story reason. But there is some value in doing that, because otherwise there would be people wondering, like, wait, is she even like – I like, what are the mechanics? How is that going to work? Is she going to roll with it? But if you establish she's been with women, she's been with men, now she's attracted to someone non-binary. Okay. It doesn't feel like the same kind of leap that if she had been just depicted strictly as heterosexual, that it might have felt like for at least some readers.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Then let's get into who you mentioned. Let's talk about the character of Sam, who is the I keep coming back to like the sort of functions of the plot, because in many ways this is just kind of like it's playing a role of sort of a gothic romance injected with a few unique elements, like bringing in a superhero character with Deadman. And in that sense, Sam is kind of the partner, the sidekick type of thing who's coming in. And by the end of it, certainly the potential love interest when the relationship with the fiancé goes terribly bad. How did you feel about the way that Sam was presented just in general?
I think Sam as a character I liked a lot. I really enjoyed them. And I think Sam is presented very respectfully. I have a couple of nitpicks, but they're like, I understand why it was done the way that it is, but I'm still kind of like on a couple of very specific, very minor points. But I do want to emphasize overall, I like Sam as a character, and I feel like their non-binary nature for them and how they portrayed that how the character was written and drawn was respectfully done.
Okay, so and this one might have been just me then. That Sam identifies, or getting into the pronoun game of it, that Sam goes by they or them. Mm-hmm. I'll be honest, and maybe I was a little bit too dense, and it took me. But like when that was first used to describe Sam, like I wasn't thinking of a non-binary character until that was actually written clearly and explicitly in the text. At first, when Sam was written as they or them, as Bernice is describing them, I thought it was like a writing error. It was throwing me off. I was just like, wait, how many characters is she talking about? Like the fact that she was going into the plural, I was like, oh, this is, wait, I'm confused. How many people are we talking? This is just bad writing. Why doesn't she? And then like, it wasn't until I actually read non-binary. It was like, oh, I get it. Okay. But so I was kind of like, is it just something where you have, like, in the text only that the pronoun gets confusing? Or, I don't know. Was it an issue for you, or was it just me?
Well, no, but obviously we have incredibly different life experiences.
Right.
And I have a lot of non-binary friends who use they, them. And look, here's the first thing I will grant. It takes some adjustment. Mm-hmm. Because they, them has other uses that are very deeply ingrained in our head. So it can take some time. And I there are still times where I have to kind of crowbar my brain into place on that. So did it throw me? No, I actually really loved that initially the only indication of Sam being non-binary was just that Bernice's inner monologue referred to them as they, them. Now, I love that. And of course, I spotted that immediately. But again, I live with that a lot more than you do. So it is not surprising to me, nor do I judge you for the fact that you didn't cordon on to that until it was made a little bit more explicit later on.
Once it was clear and I could like retroactively like reset and everything, and then I was just like, oh, okay, I see what Sarah Vaughan, the writer, is doing here, and I'm fine. And then actually Sam and all of their interactions became a lot more charged and a lot more interesting for me once that became explicit. But I just think maybe like there were a couple of instances in the story and the way it's laid out where I felt like I needed some facts presented like right from the first page, and maybe I was just particularly dense when I was reading it the first time.
Who, you? No.
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 I mean, you kind of brought this up when I asked the first question, but I mean, when she's inserting LGBTQ plus characters into this almost rote gothic, story, beyond the representational aspect of it and the value in that, does the non-binary and the bisexual status of the characters, does that enhance this story for you? Or,
well, when it comes to Sam and them being non-binary, absolutely it does. So there's a couple of things. Like, the first is, again, I'm not mad at you for the way you worded it, but I'm me, and I'm still going to bring it up. You know, the use of the terminology that frequently gets used to talk about LGBTQ plus characters, words like injected into, just the wording that a lot of the conversations have initially already frames it as an intrusion into a place where we don't belong. I suppose, for clarity, in case folks, because I haven't been on one of your podcasts in a while, I don't identify specifically as non-binary, but I'm gender fluid, so I'm kind of in that area. I don't use they, them myself, though. Anyways, a lot of the wording and the way the conversations get talked about, injecting, forced representation, and these terms, they come from a defensive position of assuming that we don't belong in these stories or these spaces. But I mean, the fact is that we exist and we have as much right to be in these stories as anybody else. But kind of like what I said before, we are frequently, and writers who put us into these stories are frequently asked to justify our existence, which, you know, frankly, which to a certain extent, I understand why that happens, but it wears you down after a while. Mm-hmm. But in terms of Sam specifically, Sam's non-binary identity and the history and the hints of their past that we get factor into this heavily. It's at the core of why they are so accepting of Bernice. Like, right when they can tell Bernice is holding something back, even before they know what it is, they're saying to her, okay, look, we'll talk when you're ready, because they have been in a situation where they knew something about themselves that they were scared to tell other people. Anyone who has ever had to come out has had that experience. And it's also why, because as a non-binary person, I guarantee you that they have had years of people, either in person, online, whatever, rejecting, denying, and refusing to acknowledge their identity and who they are. Saying that, you know, you're not what you say you are. I don't believe you. Which also factors in towards the end when Bernice does come clean and says, I see people. And, you know, her fiancé is all like, wait, what? I mean, we find out stuff with him later. But, you know, he has the, wait, there must be some other explanation. And Sam just goes, I believe you. And the reason Sam is in a place like that, I do not see it as Sam loves her already, therefore they believe her. Like, no, Sam understands what it's like to be scared to say something because you think people will say, no, that's just wrong. And they are not going to be that wall that they have had to probably beat down multiple times across their lives. So I think the fact that Sam is non-binary is key to the way that their interactions and their relationship plays out.
Well, I'm sorry for the way that I asked the question.
Again, I'm not mad at you. Like, these are the terms that come up in these conversations. And if you don't really, like, stop and think about it, mm-hmm. it's just the terms that get adopted when the topic comes up. And, like, it's the kind of thing that you have to stop and think about. So, like, again, not mad at you. You don't have to apologize.
Well, but what I was going to say, though, is I'm glad I'm happy that I got that answer from you. For one thing, because it was very informative, and the way I kind of will think about this material when bringing it up in other conversations, and the way I phrase that, I'm happy to be corrected in this way, more than happy. But also, just for the sake of your answer, in the content wise of the answer, is I really didn't think about it, because I've kind of had my head. I was really kind of approaching this story as the author took a you know, took Bluebeard or Rebecca, one of these, you know, gothic romance stories, and said, what can I do to change something and make it a little bit unique? Oh, she drops in Deadman. How is Deadman going to shake up the story? Let's make the characters queer. How is that going to change the characters? And I felt like those were kind of very artificial, after-the-fact type of changes. So I've also been maybe subconsciously thinking that you could remove any of those aspects and the plot doesn't really change all that much. You're still left with the same story. So the changes are more cosmetic in nature. And I've been, that's what I've been thinking. But the way you put it, I was like, I definitely, the fact that Sam, you wouldn't have gotten the same reaction from Sam when he learns about Bernice's, when they learn about Bernice's truth. Had it not had Sam been a different type of character. I think that's true, and I definitely think that that is more informative and more crucial to their relationship and what we think about these characters and why we root for them. So,
well, I mean, and also, if you're going to try and approach anything like this from the perspective of would the plot be different if character this wasn't X. It also depends on how much you break the plot down. Because if you're going to strip this story down to bare bones and just the plot bullet points, no, actually, it wouldn't change. But a plot is more than a skeleton. It's the muscles, it's the interactions, it's the smaller things. And so what I will say is I would not be surprised if Sarah Vaughan, I had to check, if Sarah Vaughan hadn't started this project from a position of, here's this fairly standard gothic romance plot, what happens if I put these people in it and make these changes? But the thing is, she then played out, what does that mean and what does that change? Now, did it change the skeletal plot that everything is hung on? No, but it absolutely changed the interactions, the trappings, the dynamic between characters. The plot points, still the same, but a lot of different things can be done with the same plot points if you mess with other things.
Mm-hmm. I kept on, you know, bumping up against aspects of this story when I was reading it, thinking that if you took Deadman out of this story, would it have changed? Like, how different would the story be? And I kind of feel like he's only there to kind of service exposition in certain key parts of the story. But, I mean, he is useful as another voice to kind of butt up against Bernice and kind of, like, give her mostly exposition, but a little bit of, you know, agency and help her along. How do you think the story would have been different had Deadman been the POV character instead of Bernice?
I think it would have been a little bit more engaging. You know, we have no investment whatsoever in Bernice before page one. And Vaughn is working up a pretty steep hill at that point, trying to get us to, number one, invest in this character. And when this series came out, it was prestige format. So I know now with DC Universe, it's a little more easily accessible. Mm-hmm. But as a prestige format with a $5.99 cover price, you were asking an awful lot for someone who maybe buying this for Deadman. And honestly, I bought the first issue when it came out and I stopped. And it probably only within the past year and a half have I gone, you know what, maybe I should finish that one off. And even then it took me a while to get back into it to read it because it just didn't really hit my Deadman passion. It didn't hit the character for me. To your point or your question, if you take Deadman out of the story, is it any different a story? And at some point, a supernatural character is needed for Adelia to finish her conflict. Deadman serves a purpose there. Could it have been Zatanna, Phantom Stranger, Etrigan, any of those? Probably. Mm-hmm. You know, Deadman at this point is a cardboard cutout of Deadman, and Lan Medina makes him look good, but I just don't. He's not necessary to the story, and it's not your typical Deadman story. And putting him POV would have been a really different story. In that, just how he came into the story, he heard somebody in trouble and he went to find out. And I don't know that we've ever, and it's been a little while, and I haven't gone that deep, but I don't know that we've ever had Deadman use that as his MO.
Yeah, and right off the bat, once we start the story, which I felt was a little bit jarring because we're seeing him kind of in the background because Bernice can see him, but he isn't our POV, so she's just kind of aware of him and kind of noticing him, but not interacting with him because he's a ghost and she's in public with other people. So there is this kind of weird distance. So we have to kind of see through her eyes that he's trying to do things that he can't do. He's trying to go through walls that he can't go through. He's trying to, like, possess people, and he's bouncing off of them. And it's this kind of, like, weird way of, you know, complicating his powers, sort of grounding him a little bit or nerfing him. But we don't have a baseline for what his power set is in the beginning of this story to juxtapose that. So, I don't know.
Yeah, yeah, and it seemed to me like the story felt like it was missing context that never crossed over from Vaughn to Medina. So maybe there were like script notes or things that would have helped set that for us, that would have brought us along a little bit more, that maybe Medina had the luxury of, because like I said, there were script notes. Mm-hmm. And if I'm not mistaken, I think Vaughn was a novelist or is a novelist.
I believe
as her primary. So, you know, clearly there's some stuff that went into the construct of the story that maybe helped with the setting that probably could have helped with this as well.
I could see it being told without Dead Man, but I couldn't. I think it would be probably at least an issue shorter. But I enjoyed Benita's interactions with Boston so much. I just love seeing him on panel. It was pleasurable to me, but strict necessity, no. But I think if you didn't have Dead Man there, it would be pretty much your basic Secrets of Forbidden Mansion, whatever, Secrets of Sinister House, early 70s type DC one issue romantic love story. Whereas with Dead Man, it just puts it in the DC universe, and yeah, perhaps brings a few more readers to the book. But I can't be advised, Ryan. I just like Dead Man so much.
No, I understand that, and I'm kind of there too. But I kept on thinking between Bernice, who can see and communicate with ghosts, you've got another ghost in the story with Adelia, and you've got Sam as her kind of sidekick partner who's willing to go to the ends of the earth with her.
Yes.
I think between the three of those characters, you probably could have gotten through this entire story and the sort of their journey, and they could have survived this whole thing without the help of Boston Brand in the story. But as a visual medium, as this, for the story, I agree with you. I love seeing him on the panel. The vibrancy of his costume, the colors, the look, the red splashes and everything that he does. Ironically, he brings a life to this story that otherwise, it's a fairly rote kind of gothic story. You know, it ticks off certain boxes and everything, the story. It's not unpredictable. It's not breaking any ground. But I think Dead Man's presence in there does liven things up, I guess. Ironically, he does provide a new kind of energy that makes it a little bit more interesting for a comic book story.
I think it does, you know, and the way it ends, you know, it's not setting up a sequel, but it leaves open the possibilities that, you know, these characters might get together again, and mm-hmm. so far they haven't. I would love it one day if we just got some kind of sequel. I mean, I wouldn't even necessarily need Dead Man there. I'd just love to see Bernice pop up in a Madame Xanadu story or something like that. Just I like the new characters so much that I'd love to know more about Sam's story.
Yeah, they could. It was have them throw them in with Madame Xanadu or some of the other kind of occult characters. They've had characters like that they've never really used to their fullest, like a Doctor Occult and Rose type of thing, or like post the series 52 when they, you know, they set up Ralph Dibny and Sue to be like ghost detectives and everything like that. They certainly could use Bernice and Sam in a function sort of like that. That would be interesting.
I think it would be, I can't even remember if we ever saw Ralph and Sue as psychic detectives after that 52, whether that ever happened anywhere or
I don't think so. That was set up at the, I think, like the very end of 52, like the last issue. I don't think we saw them again until Blackest Night, when they came back as zombies. And then it was a long, long time before they came back in the new 52 era. I think Gail Simone brought them back.
Interesting stuff. But no, I mean, any time I can see Dead Man is pretty good for me.
how quickly did you become suspicious that Nathan, the boyfriend, was the bad guy?
Oh, immediately. as soon as I knew he had a study that she never went into, I'm like, oh, he's the bad guy.
Yeah. I was like, I've read this story before.
The thing is, I'm not sure that they really try to play that as a twist. I mean, like, it doesn't deliberately tip its hand, but, like, I don't think that the story thinks it's pulling one over on anybody.
No, his behavior, he doesn't do anything explicitly that would make you cast suspicion about him. But the fact that a lot of weird stuff seems to happen as soon as he walks in the room that he seems oblivious to, it's like, suspicious.
Oh, yeah.
I was going to ask about the art, but any other, you know, thoughts in general about the story or other aspects of the characters?
Well, I want to come back to one thing, because this actually ties to something that you brought up earlier, that, you know, you kind of needed Sam being non-binary to be spelled out a little bit more explicitly. And I kind of wanted to talk about the moment where that happens, because what happens is Boston misgenders Sam, and Bernice corrects him and says, well, Sam uses they, them. They're non-binary. I have a little issue with that scene. First of all, let me acknowledge that it should be there. I actually kind of went back and forth on whether or not it needed to be there until we started having this conversation. And we were like, you didn't get it until that scene. I'm like, okay, yeah, people who aren't me could probably use this. So, like, this isn't written just for me. So let's extend an olive branch. Sure, put the scene there. It should be there. What I wish had been, and this is going to sound very minor, but it does kind of irk me. I wish that when Boston misgendered Sam, that he had gone, he, she, I wasn't sure that, but instead Boston identifies her as she, which Bernice then corrects. I actually have a little bit of a problem with that, because the presumption is that he is identifying Sam's sex assigned at birth. And the reason I don't like that being there, even if it's only implied, is that it brings to the forefront the question that is the absolutely inappropriate question that is in the back of way too many people's minds whenever they encounter a trans or non-binary person, which is, what is in their pants?
Right, right.
And I wish that he had only been confused and, like, didn't know which it was, because him saying she, readers are going to take that as, oh, the voice, or, you know, things beyond the, because the visual cues don't give you much, but, you know, Boston would have heard their voice. And so you can presume that if Boston presumed she, that's probably what Sam was assigned at birth. But what Sam was assigned at birth is irrelevant. And even laying in that information, like I said, it puts into people's heads, oh, that's what's in their pants. No, it's none of your business what's in their pants.
Right. They default to the biological
exactly. Okay. So people reading it either don't understand or aren't accepting of non-binary are going to think, oh, it's really a woman. Mm-hmm. So yeah. I really wish that it would have been such a minor change.
Had Boston's line just been retweaked so that he was, like, confused without giving away
exactly.
Yeah, one way or another, you know, what she was.
Because in a way, like, the comic book had the opportunity to do something that you can't do in, say, film or television, because in film or television you would hear the voice of the performer, and most non-binary people, their voice is not 100% gender neutral. You can usually tell, if you're gonna get hung up about it, from their voice where they started from in terms of who they were assigned at birth versus where they are now. But in a comic where you don't hear the voice, you have the opportunity to just not signify any of that, and to truly give people who are reading it, anyone who then talks about it, no option but to call Sam anything but they. But by putting she in there, anyone who wants to be a jerk about it now has the option of misgendering them because they think they know who they really are.
Right.
And that's wrong.
Right. Yeah, I mean, this goes well beyond the scope of this story, but that is something that you can do with comics that you can't do with other media, is when, like, you know, superhero comics will have a character in the shadows who is speaking that will eventually be revealed to be a character that we know. And if it was any other form of media where you could hear the person's voice, then the you give away the game. We know who that character is, even if we can't see him, because we recognize the voice. But in a comic book, there's no audio component to it, so it's just the words. So we
I mean, it's the reason they keep doing ridiculous stuff with Batman's voice in the live action movies.
Yeah.
It's like, just leave it alone. Like, trust a little suspension of disbelief. But to be fair, it doesn't play as well when that component's in there. And it's something mediums have strengths. There are things that you can do and or get away with in comics or well, every media. Every media has unique things that other media either can't do at all or can't do as well.
Last question that I have then. Thinking about the art, particular panels or pages that you wanted to single out?
Well, I mean, every page I just really enjoyed looking at. But the first standout to me is that initial appearance of Deadman on panel when, you know, he's a wraith speeding above Sam's truck. He's like distorted on panel rather than being the normal sort of very human person floating majestically through the panel. He's just zooming like red and white ectoplasm, like something from Ghostbusters or something. But you don't even see his, in that first panel and the second panel over the page, you don't even see his head, you don't see his face. And so a character that I've seen thousands of times suddenly becomes unfamiliar and actually seems spooky. Another page I really liked was the page in which Deadman asks Adelia, the ghost, the female ghost, if she's okay, if she's sad. And she declares that she's not sad, she's blooming angry. And she's, you know, basically she's found a sense of self again after 150 years. And I think that's really, really brilliantly depicted by Medina. The change of expression, it's just very, very convincing. There's a page at the end of chapter 3 as Bernice leaves the house and we see Boston and Adelia at the window behind her looking out towards her. They seem, they look like classic unknowable spirits. It's very eerie, you know?
It's kind of funny. It reminds me of the painting American Gothic with the couple at the front, because there's always like, people are always playing with that painting with like the house, like the window, the attic window in the back, and like, can you see something in there? Was there something in, like, people have made like tweaks and adjustments to that painting and everything to try and add spooky things in the background there. And this is sort of an inversion, because we see her in the foreground walking away with them standing together like that old couple in the window. It's really cool.
It is. Like, it's like the world's spookiest cuckoo clock or something. And finally, I mean, I love the way the ghost, the female ghost Adelia, is shown when she is in her dark, vengeful spirit form, the form, you know, the version of herself that she didn't realise she was. It just looks, again, brilliant on panel, just this expansive black ethereal stuff, like black ectoplasm or something. And also, I like the complimentary typeface at the veteran letter, Janice. I've never said this out loud. Janice Chiang, Janice Chiang.
Chiang.
It is Chang, but I think that looks great with the image. But basically, it's just a luscious book. There's so many wonderful images, courtesy of, you know, the artist Lan Medina, who I don't actually know, and colorist Jose Villarubi. Do you know Lan Medina at all?
I remember him from doing a couple of like Silver Surfer miniseries about 10 years ago, and then he was actually the lead penciler on Aquaman and the Others, the spin-off series, the Aquaman series. He had a different inker with him to give him much more of a more or less conventional style and everything. And then he did the Mira miniseries, Mira Queen of Atlantis miniseries too.
Oh, I should remember. I reviewed that. I really, really liked that. Very, very enjoyable book. I wasn't so into Aquaman and the Others, but the Mira miniseries was just a lot of fun.
I agree. I think like those pages when Adelia is sort of taken over by it looks like black kind of inky smoke. And when you contrast that with just like the hard red outline around Nathan when he's possessed, when Boston has kind of taken him over, that color contrast is really good.
In general, his art reminded me a lot of Phil Winslade. And I know Lan's been around a lot. He's working on Agents of Wakanda now. Mm. There are some great shots of Deadman, especially the top or the first image in Book 1, Chapter 2. If you just Google Deadman cosplay, there's a guy out there, and I don't remember when it was, but he had like a leather Deadman suit and fogged over contacts for his eyes and just absolutely nailed the look. And Medina is totally drawing that guy as Deadman. Huh. That's his point of reference. He's using a lot of very human people. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, Bernice is uneven throughout. In some panels, she does look Asian or have a very Asian appearance, but in other panels, it's almost a totally different character. And there are some panels that are constructed just to be more comic booky, and they just kind of fail in their story. But overall, the art's good. Is it great? Is it prestige format worthy? No. Was it good on an iPad reading it on DC Universe? Yeah, it was pretty good there. The three images that really struck me are that one that I mentioned, Adelia's transformation at the end of book two, mm-hmm. and then the final image of Dead Man.
I'm not sure I could name a favorite, but I thought the art was gorgeous. I really did. I thought the art was phenomenal, especially with the more ghostly happenings going on. There was a wonderful ethereal nature to those aspects and those elements. I thought it was gorgeous. As far as the story overall, I think it's good. I think it is exactly what it intends to be. It is a slightly tweaked classic gothic horror romance. Mm-hmm. And I can appreciate it for executing that well, the same way I can appreciate something like Crimson Peak, mm-hmm. you know, the Guillermo del Toro movie. Does it completely reinvent the wheel? No, but that's a dang pretty wheel.
Any other like final thoughts? Did you like the story or no?
I don't know that I'll be rushing back to read it. A couple of things art-wise. I mentioned, you know, Bernice has kind of an uneven quality throughout. Janice Chang's lettering doesn't always cooperate. The sound effects were kind of jarring. But, you know, that's just another thing. That's a nit that I'm picking at this point where maybe I'm trying to not like it. It's a decent enough story. I think it works better as maybe a horror story, leave Dead Man out of it, but maybe they were trying to hop on, I don't know if popularity is the right term, but Dead Man's popularity. You know, I mean, he was just involved in Brightest Day at that point. Well, not just, but
yeah, that was, you know, like 5 years earlier.
Yeah, half a decade removed from Brightest Day. And truly, it looks like this was just a run at renewing a copyright with the Dark Mansion of Forbidden Love title, right?
I think so. I think I read like an interview like that's like it was like the editors came to Sarah Vaughan and basically said, "We've got these things, Dark Mansion of Forbidden Love. Can you tell a story like that? And it has to have Dead Man in it." Yeah. I think that was the genesis of it. So
yeah, I definitely think it would have been a better Phantom Stranger story.
Yeah, maybe I can see Phantom Stranger, Madame Xanadu, somebody else kind of coming into
it. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I hadn't thought Madame Xanadu, but I like that angle on it. Kind of would have fit in line with her short-lived Matt Wagner series, actually.
And also, I mean, they established that, you know, Bernice being bisexual, too, that could play into something with Madame Xanadu, too. Who knows?
Yeah, absolutely. I will tell you this much, though. There are zero Jose Luis Garcia Lopez, praise be his name, panels within this series.
So from there, it is immediately an inferior Dead Man story.
Dismissed.
No, actually, it was just such a pleasure to be asked to be prompted to read this again, because previously I read it in installments when it came out, and with half of my head on, you know, in its sort of blog reviewing mode, whereas this time I was just reading it for pleasure and, you know, scribbling the odd note afterwards.
Thank you for giving me the book, too. Thank you for sending it to me. I appreciate it.
Oh, you're welcome. I know I was a terrible nag. Have you read it? Oh, I'm going to send it to you then. You'll have to read it one day.
Yeah.
But I'm glad you read it anyway. Thank you so much.
I knew I wanted to do something special for the big 31st episode, yeah. The big Halloween episode for this year. So this was a good treat to bring it to that one. So.
No, thank you for letting me back into your house of wonderment.
No problem. So. Martin, where else can people find you if they want to hear more of your thoughts on comics or anything else?
Well, I do a blog, Too Dangerous for a Girl, and as I always have to say, I wish I'd never picked that title because it's terribly sexist when in fact it's irony. It's based on an old Legion of Superheroes panel with Saturn Girl. But anyway, Too Dangerous for a Girl, I've just done a blog today on the 1027th issue of Detective Comics, which, stupid me, is 144 pages, so that took forever. And because they're such these pricey books, they rarely get read, so you don't get that many views. But never mind. I enjoy the comic a lot. And you can also find me on @MartGray at Twitter and around the Fire and Water Network boards and elsewhere.
Where else can people find you if they want to know more about your thoughts on Dead Man or any other character in comics?
Pretty much the only spot I'm at right now is Twitter. And even that's infrequent. It's just a matter of the way life is right now, trying to balance things out. And balance frequently means neglecting other things. But I'm on Twitter at DZavisha, Z-A-W-I-S-Z-A. And that's where I'll be sharing comic thoughts and sometimes comic art and things of that nature.
Well, the main thing is going to be if you look for Council of Geeks, you will find most of my stuff. You'll find me on YouTube. You'll find me on Twitter. You'll find me on Patreon, which is actually what is paying my bills. I'm doing this nonsense professionally now. What the hell? And, you know, social medias and other things like that. If you want to hear more about my personal gender journey in specific, you can also look up Vera Wilde. Wilde is spelled W-Y-L-D-E because I had to spell it as pretentiously as humanly possible.
For years, the Fire and Water Podcast Network has found its joy talking about comics. From Aquaman and Firestorm to Batman and Plastic Man. From giant treasuries to pocket-sized digests. From massive miniseries events to singular one-shot adventures. From romance to horror to whatever the hell Ohamu or not is. In the last year, they've begun to carve a path through their favorite television shows, such as MASH, Cheers, and Justice League Unlimited, and there's no sign of them stopping. What medium will Fire and Water conquer next?
Do you like good music?
Introducing Fire and Water Records, the music anthology podcast from the Fire and Water Network. Find your joy in all new ways as members of the Fire and Water Network and their friends discuss favorite songs, albums, concerts, and artists.
Hang on, I've been doing a music show for 2 years.
Featuring Record Revolution.
Join the Brothers Daily as we catalog the essential years that shaped popular music and our own lives.
A Very Daily Christmas.
An annual celebration of our favorite holiday tracks.
Plus, all new episodes of Zoom for Sam.
The show in which I share my joy of Samantha Fox by spotlighting a single every single episode.
And Pod Dylan.
No, not Pod Dylan. We discussed this. That's staying on its own feed.
Not Pod Dylan, but everything else I said. Plus, so much more. There's even a chance David Ace Gutierrez will show up.
Which brings us back to Fastball, which is really one of the most interesting American bands in the world today. When you think about the number of side projects and solo projects associated with the band, it actually almost outdoes.
Fire and Water Records, a proud part of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. All right, I'm back. And before I tell you the shocking announcement about this podcast, I want to cover the listener feedback from the last show. Episode 30 of Midnight the Podcasting Hour featured Siskoid helping me cover issues 9 and 10 of Swamp Thing, which were the last two issues drawn by Bernie Wrightson, and then Rob Kelly joined me to cover issue 10 of The Phantom Stranger by Jim Aparo. In addition to the much-appreciated likes and shares and retweets on social media, the episode received a couple of comments on the Fire and Water website, which you can find at fireandwaterpodcast.com. The first comment came from Chris Franklin, who does the House of Frankenstein specials with his wife Cindy, as well as JLU cast right here on the network. Chris said, "Great episode. My only disappointment was special guest host Oscar Constantine never said anything about apples and pears, the numpty." To which Andrew Leyland from the Palace of Glittering Delights piped in on Oscar's behalf, explaining, "Oscar Constantine is from Liverpool. Apples and pears is Cockney rhyming slang. Accuse Oscar of being a sissy southerner and he'll gut you like a fish." Oh, that's kind of an extreme response, but anyway. Chris goes on, "Obviously it is cold on that beach, as evidenced by that one panel of Abby in her bikini. The Comics Code Authority was asleep at the wheel again. Thousands of kids were traumatized." This time Edo Boznar chimed in, "Traumatized? Is that what they're calling it nowadays? Then I was similarly traumatized by images of comic books many times in my misspent youth." And Chris continues, I blame Siskoid for making me think of Anton Arcane's dong, or his undong, which probably has a face on it. Nightmare fuel. For that, I blame Ryan. As for the Phantom Stranger story, I think those ladies may be hanging out at the Universal Monsters Cafe at Universal Studios, Florida. It's more of an overpriced theme park fast food joint, but the decor is similar. Dr. Ange from the Supergirl blog said, the alien Swamp Thing issue was my first exposure to the character, bought at one of the yard sales my dad and I went to each summer in the mid to late 70s. Even then, as a little kid, I was floored by the rights and art, especially the splash of the alien. This wasn't a Vince Coletta inked book. Oh, God. Vince Coletta inking rights and... Just thinking about that. You can't tell, but my eyes are twitching now. Ange says, and yes, this was one of many Man is the Monster stories I read in this time period. I felt like I was a bit in the know when there was the Invasion sequel decades later. Alan Moore also did a slavery slash racism story in his American Gothic arc. I wonder if it was an homage to the one covered here. It could be. It wouldn't surprise me if it was, but then again, I mean... When you've got stories, when you've got horror stories set in the Deep South, you look at sort of the foundational thematic elements that we associate with that place, and one of them is the long and bloody legacy of slavery. And just like, as I mentioned this on the last Fire and Water Records, like this region is just kind of ripe with... you know, the various cultural and religious fusions of like Judeo-Christianity and the Caribbean islands and all of this cultural melting pot sort of, and you get a lot of stories out there and you get a lot of mysticism and spirituality. So, and also just the bayou, the swamp is like the one still undiscovered country within America. It's a place that seems like darker and unexplored and fantastical. So that's just, I mean, that's why you have Swamp Thing and Man Thing, why they're based there. And yeah, so that doesn't necessarily have to do with the slavery angle, but I think it feels like a natural offshoot that anybody who's telling a story down there, a horror story, might invoke that angle. All that said, yes, Alan Moore might have been homaging this story. But moving on. Paul Hicks from The Gary Show said, I can't believe Tim Price did every voice in this episode. Astounding. Wasn't it, though? Yeah, Tim is quite talented. And Siskoid from Ohatmu or Not, give me that Star Trek, and many, many other shows here on the Fire and Water Network, he said, I love that kick to the head in the Phantom Stranger story, but with all due respect to Jim Aparo, he always makes me feel like he's treating the Phantom Stranger no different from Batman. Now, that cover, if the stories were more like that, but I'm no expert. Well, I mean, I haven't read a ton, maybe half a dozen, maybe as many as like 10 Phantom Stranger stories from that run. And I don't think he's always that physical. So I certainly wouldn't say that Aparo's treating him like Batman. Well, I mean, in the story that you read, yeah, he definitely does get that way. But yeah, I mean... As great as the story was, I mean, that cover is the Neil Adams cover of Phantom Stranger 10 is of such a singular quality. Yeah, can't be beat. Before the end, I wanted to address a couple more iTunes reviews or Apple Podcasts reviews, and I honestly cannot remember the last time I read reviews on this podcast, so I'm just going to read the two that I got within the last year. The first one is from Scarlet Bordeaux Fan and says... Ryan has done it again. This podcast hits it out of the park. Ryan and his guests draw you in and do a great job of getting the visuals out there. I love the Deadman and Spectre stories the best. 5 stars all the way. Thank you, Ryan. Well, no, thank you. That's very nice to hear and very nice to get a review like that. I hope you liked this Deadman tale that we just talked about. I know it's a little bit different than what's come before, but hopefully it was enjoyable. And the other new review is from Ratasetti. Thank you for filling the void for the great but not forgotten Parliament of Rooks podcast. Listen to some of your other podcasts and you can feel the passion. I sometimes think that you are too intelligent for the medium, so it is hard sometimes for me to keep up. Guys, I swear I did not write this myself. That is my problem, not yours. I'm giving you 5 stars for your effort. Keep up the good work. God, thank you so again so much. It's great to hear. Too intelligent for this? No. I don't think that's right. Anyway, a huge thanks to everyone who left a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever, and everyone who left a comment on the website post as well. Thanks a bunch. And yeah, that is going to wrap up the listener feedback section, which brings me to a very important announcement about this podcast. If you know my work, you probably could have guessed this was coming. 2020 has claimed yet another victim. This will be the last episode of Midnight, the Podcasting Hour. Back on episode 27, Shag and I were snooping around PJ Frightful's studio looking for him, and we discovered that he had contracted the coronavirus. Since then, I have been fortunate enough to have several wonderful guests pitch in as substitute hosts introducing the new episodes. But it's gotten harder and harder to do the show without PJ. And I can now confirm that PJ Frightful has passed away again, sort of, this time due to complications from COVID-19. And with this being Halloween, you know, 4 years after the show started, I feel like it's time to retire this podcast. So I want to thank all of the guests who made this experience so
true. Okay, but, Ryan, that's enough.
Whoa, what are you guys doing here?
You need to stop. This is getting ridiculous.
What are you?
It's an intervention, Ryan.
We're here because we care about you.
Well, I don't know about that.
Okay, we're here because you're an important part of this group?
Yeah, I mean, kinda.
How about what Ryan does is a reflection on us?
Yeah, that's fine.
To the
that's
extent
okay.
that I care, sure.
Stop it. This is really, you're holding an intervention because I'm canceling another podcast? I don't do it that often. There have been a few select...
Whoa, killer. That's not why we're here. This isn't about you canceling the podcast.
Yeah, we don't care one way or another about that.
This is about PJ.
What do you mean?
You need to drop the act. We all know the truth. You can't blame the death of PJ Frightful for why you're ending the podcast.
But
Ryan, you are PJ Frightful.
I knew he would do that sound effect.
See, this is what we're talking about. That's not a dramatic reveal, Ryan. Everybody knows you do the voice for PJ Frightful. This whole thing with him going missing and pretending to have COVID.
Which, by the way, I'm not sure was all that funny back in July, and now that a million people have died from it.
And now you're dragging poor Tim Price and Paul Hicks into this craziness, making them play along.
Oh, craziness?
Yeah. That you would go to such lengths to justify canceling a podcast you're not happy with? That's pretty crazy.
We don't think you're in a very healthy place, Ryan.
That's why we brought in a sort of expert in unhappiness.
You got a psychiatrist?
No, we voted not to use Patreon money on that.
Ryan, we need you to face the truth. We need you to recognize what's making you unhappy with Midnight the Podcasting Hour. And then, if you still want to cancel it, we won't have an issue with that.
And since we don't have the time for an entire therapy session and, you know, breaking down your walls or whatever, we just brought in someone who's really good at making people unhappy.
Who?
How's my fifth favorite daily doing?
You gotta be kidding me.
Guys, let's give them some privacy.
Wasn't this all being recorded anyway?
Okay, so why do you hate Midnight, the Podcasting Hour?
I don't hate it.
But you want to cancel it.
For reasons, yes, but not because I hate it.
How can you not, though? Doesn't it feel like a giant chain around your neck? Doesn't the failure just sit on your chest when you're lying in bed?
Failure? It's not a failure.
But it's not exactly the show you described when you started, is it?
I changed the format a little bit because my circumstances changed.
You changed the format a couple of times, didn't you?
Yeah.
Because you weren't happy with it.
Because things changed, or I changed.
this was your follow-up to Secret Origins, right? Everyone who loved that show, this is what you wanted them to hear next? How do you think it lived up to the hype?
I did 31 episodes. I stuck to the overall theme. I had great guests. I produced a show of quality that anybody could be proud of. I don't compare it to Secret Origins or any other one of my shows.
What about other people's shows?
What do you mean?
Like House of Frankenstein, for example. Similar theme. Is that a good show?
House of Frankenstein is awesome.
You really think so?
Yes. House of Frankenstein is one of the best things on the network.
And that doesn't bother you? That doesn't make you feel like a failure?
Chris and Cindy's show? Why would it?
Because your podcast, which is all about horror, isn't even the best horror-themed show on the Fire and Water Network.
No. It doesn't bother me.
Okay. Why are you canceling Midnight, then?
I don't want to do the show without PJ Frightful. It doesn't feel right.
Where is he?
He died.
Wasn't he already undead or something?
He died again.
When?
Earlier this year.
The other guys say PJ is just a character you made up, that you do the voice.
Well, they said he said.
Yeah, I don't think I believe them.
You don't?
That PJ Frightful is just a voice you do? No, that's not your thing at all. I mean, when you did the reading of the Denny O'Neill story on Nightcast, Chris did all the cool Batman dialogue, right?
Yeah, but I did the others.
But you don't do, like, character voices, right? That was Zoom's thing.
Yeah.
Zoom did all the voices of the Zoom crew. The Terra Man accent, the Bizarro speech, the robots, all of that. That was Zoom. He was the guy who did the voices.
Right.
I guess Shag was the voice of Darkseid on Zoom show, too.
Yeah.
Rob was on it, too. Siskoid was the voice of Desaad. Was Chris Franklin on Zoom show?
Yeah.
Who else?
Lots of people.
Who?
Max Romero, Michael Bailey, Stella, Nathaniel and Liss. I think half the guys from the Longbox Crusade. A bunch of other people were on it.
Voicing characters.
Yes.
What about you?
I was never on it.
Never?
No.
Yeah, that's why I don't think PJ Frightful is a voice you made up. If you had a character voice thing that you did, Zoom would have asked you to be on his show, right?
I don't know what went into Zoom's decision-making. Maybe he just ran out of time.
Sure. Because otherwise, that would be insulting, right? To ask everyone on the network, even some of the French girls, to do voices. But not you. I mean, let's say if you were the voice of PJ Frightful doing that every episode, and Zoom didn't have you on his show, that would be kind of embarrassing, wouldn't it? I mean, that would make me want to stop doing the voice.
What do you want, Dave?
I'm not your therapist, Ryan. I just want Secret Origins back.
Do it yourself.
You know what the music means. Say hi to your brother Neil, your wife Angela, your son Reese, your father Patrick, your mother Lorraine, and whatever Diego is for me. I like them better than you, and pretty sure the feeling is mutual.
You're an asshole for bringing Zoom into this.
Blame the writer for that.
Well, how'd it go?
Are you a Highlander fan yet?
Well, you wanted him to piss me off. We definitely achieved that.
What about PJ Frightful?
PJ Frightful did not die of COVID or anything else. He's just a voice I made up. Part Crypt Keeper, part chain-smoking math teacher I had once. I concocted this whole death scenario because I was just going through some stuff.
What about the show now?
I don't know. I still feel like I've done all I want to do with it.
And that's okay. We'll stand by you, Ryan. As long as you're honest with your audience and most of all with yourself. Plus, we don't really listen to it either way.
This is literally the first I've heard of Midnight.
You were just on the last episode.
No, I mean the word Midnight. We just don't have that where I come from.
You don't have Midnight?
Time is different in Canada.
Anyway, thank you guys. This means a lot. And I'm okay now. You can take off. I've got to do the sign-off thing. Well, I'll say this. I certainly won't miss recording in this creepy radio station basement.
never have to put up with this doing, giving those Star Wars. Hang on, did I cancel that show? I don't even remember. All right, well. Okay, long box of comics, check. Microphone, check. The bells are just about to boom, right on time. Midnight, the podcasting hour, is part of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. Feedback for the show can be left at fireandwaterpodcast.com or the Facebook page for Midnight, the podcasting hour. You can find me on Twitter at RyanDaily01 or send an email to rdailypodcast@gmail.com. You can also support Midnight, the podcasting hour, and the Fire and Water Network on Patreon. Special thanks to What the hell? Creepy as hell. Shag, is that you? Did you guys come back? Hello? Somebody there? Ah, Ryan, don't go crazy for real now.
Guess who?
No!
Oh, it's so good to be home.
You stabbed me.
Oh, Ryan. So disappointing.
You're not real.
We had so much fun together at first. I thought we were besties. But you haven't been acting like a friend lately. You tried to kill me off. Then you went and told them all my secrets. And worst of all, you tried to convince them that I was nothing but a silly voice you made up. Oh, Ryan, I think your hour is up. Watch the knife now. This is gonna hurt. That's why I call it the Snyder Cut.
Good.
reflections cast away our past empty inside. Up into hell and back again, and it's all I've been infected by a solitary sunrise. I curse in vain against the pain of velvet sky. May God forgive me.